Welcome to Food for Thought, the place to explore, celebrate, and manifest a life motivated and defined by unconditional compassion and optimal wellness. My name is Colleen Patrick-Goudreau. I'm your host. You can find me at joyfulvegan.com. You can find me on social media, Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. And you can find me here if you subscribe to this podcast, Food for Thought, at iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, or wherever you listen to podcasts. If you're enjoying this free podcast called Food for Thought, I hope you are inspired to share it with others and leave ratings and reviews and to help keep it going. This is 100% listener-supported podcast. I hope you value this content enough to support it by becoming a patron at patreon.com/ColleenPatrickGoudreau. Thank you so much in advance, and thank you to all of my supporters. First of all, hi, everybody. As I write this, the Amazon rainforest is burning up, and major media are reporting that the main culprit is the destruction of the rainforest for growing feed for cattle. So farmers pushing up against the forest, burning the forest to grow feed for cattle, which of course is then the cattle are killed for human consumption. Of course, this is exacerbated by drought conditions, and it's not good. And I know it is so hard to deal with this and feel helpless, watching this happen and feeling like we can't do anything. I feel the same way. My small part is offering my 30-day vegan challenge online program for free indefinitely, because I know so many people are motivated to do something different, to reduce their consumption of animal flesh and fluids, or to become vegan, or just become whatever you want to do with the information. But I really encourage everyone who has ever been motivated to make a personal change to help this bigger picture. And I am confident this program will help you. So go to 30dayveganchallenge.com, sign up for free, and please, please, please share it with everyone you know. In other hopeful news, my book, The Joyful Vegan, How to Stay Vegan in a World That Wants You to Eat Meat, Dairy, and Eggs, is coming out very soon. I have an advanced copy in my hands right now. So excited about it. If you go to joyfulvegan.com, you can pre-order the book. You can read just these beautiful endorsements from colleagues who have read the book and believe in this book. It's coming out in November of 2019, and I can't wait for it to be in your hands. As you may know, I have a book tour scheduled. I will be speaking in, I'm trying to do this off the top of my head, South Carolina in Hilton Head. I'll be in Boston, Massachusetts. I'll be in Tempe, Arizona. I will, for two talks, one at a bookstore, one at the university. I will be in Orlando, Florida. And of course, our book launch party is here in Oakland. And if you are in the San Francisco Bay Area and would like to join me, you can go to joyfulvegan.com and get your tickets. We're going to have fabulous food and drinks, and I'll be selling and signing books. And if you haven't pre-ordered the book, I mean, you can get the book whenever you like, but pre-orders do matter. They boost the ranking of a book and thus boost sales and thus boost the number of people who learn about the book. And mainly, the main thing is that people read the book. And that's why writers write, so you can read what we write. You can blame The Joyful Vegan, the book, for my sporadic podcast schedule, because it consumes me, and now it's consuming me in the marketing aspect, setting up interviews, helping my marketing director at my publisher write pitches to, you know, to just, again, increase the interviews I get, the number of people I can talk to about the content, which I think is incredibly important. I am very proud of this book. We'll talk more about it as time goes on. It is not just about staying vegan. It is about finding hope and joy and meaning in a world that can feel pretty difficult to do that in sometimes. Finally, other good news, our South of France trips are filling up. But if we don't have the minimum number of folks signed up by September, you know, I hate dating things on this podcast, but let's just say if we don't have the minimum folks signed up soon, the trips are not happening. This is the trip to Provence and the trip to Dordogne. So if you're interested at all, secure your spot now before A, they sell out, and B, before we have to cancel them because we didn't have enough signups. We have to let the hotels know by a certain time. They can't hold the rooms for us indefinitely. So don't think, oh, yeah, I'm interested, but I'll sign up in December. You can't. They're not a go if we don't have enough signups. So it really will be the most fabulous summer holiday ever. It's the south of France. If you've never been, it's an incredibly beautiful place. And it is very difficult to eat out not eating animal products. So if you come with us on our CPG vegan trips to the south of France, you will enjoy a cooking demo with yours truly. After we go to a local Provençal market and get produce, we're going to go, I'm most excited about this. I may have mentioned this before. We're going to the Lascaux Cave to see the replicas of 17,000 year old animal paintings. The Lascaux Cave, there's a replica cave right next door to the Lascaux Cave. So I'm super excited about that. These are animal paintings. These are just the first evidence of cave art in kind of Western civilization. So it's pretty cool. We're going to France's first and only elephant sanctuary, really Europe's first and only elephant sanctuaries in the Dordogne region. We're going to take a boat ride down the Dordogne River. We're doing several village, town, and castle guided walking tours with our own professional local French guide, French-speaking guide. You will also be going to a winery. You'll make your own wine. We're going to visit the French market I mentioned in the cooking demo. We are having a day out at sea visiting La Calanque, which is incredibly gorgeous, on our own private catamaran. We're visiting the world's best preserved Roman ruins. We're canoeing under an aqueduct and touring a still functioning Roman theater. Lots of surprises along the way and experiencing it all with me and my husband David and two of the best tour leaders I know, Seb and Brighty from World Vegan Travel. I'm excited to offer these trips. I hope you join us. These are the first ever vegan tours to these regions. So you can go to cpgtrips.com. You can sign up for each one separately, or you can sign up for both and get a discount. Some people are coming to both. They're shorter trips than usual, so that you can come to both and not feel like you're going to be gone for a month. You won't be gone for a month. However, I was just gone for a month, and we'll talk about that when we were in Rwanda. We also sold out of our Botswana and Cape Town trip when we were in Rwanda. And because of that, there was a huge demand to offer a second one. So my partners, Brighty and Seb at World Vegan Travel, kind of bent over backwards to make it happen. So it's going to be the same fabulous trip as the first one. Like I said, that's already sold out. The only difference is that I won't be there on the second one. You won't even notice that I'm not there. You're going to have the most amazing time. So go to cpgtrips.com to sign up for that one. Secure your spot. That one's a go. That one's a go. So sign up before that one sells out. That's what happened to Rwanda, to the Rwanda trip. It sold out. The second one sold out because the first one sold out. And so there you go. So you're going to see lions and rhinos and elephants and hippos and so much more. I wish we lived in a world where these animals were valued for their own sake and just to go see them and not have to make it this, you know, money-making scheme for the camps and for the countries we go to. But honestly, your support of these trips on African safaris means the conservation of these animals and their habitat, which is a perfect segue to today's topic. We just got back from being in Rwanda for a month, so today's topic is wildlife tourism. Is it legit? Is it something to be concerned about? Etc. So the highlight of the Rwanda trips is, of course, all the animals we saw in the three main national parks in this country. Of course, the mountain gorillas being the apex of all the animals we see. It's just the way it is. In response to photos I was posting of the mountain gorillas, I was posting these photos on Instagram, on Facebook while I was in Rwanda. A follower on Instagram wrote, I don't know if it was Instagram or Facebook, but wrote that the gorillas don't need human beings disturbing them and coming to gawk at them, and that doing so just perpetuates the idea that animals are here for us to be our entertainment. That taking photos of wild animals in such places just furthers the notion that they're here for us, for our pleasure. When some other followers tried to explain what the whole model is, she said, we were all just drinking the Kool-Aid and believing the lies so that we can feel better about exploiting these animals and visiting what is essentially a glorified zoo, in her words. Now, there's a lot of schlock on social media. Some of it makes its way to my social media accounts, and I'm accused of all manner of things from followers, fans, and strangers alike. I certainly don't feel the need to defend myself against every accusation, and many people who come on and have no interest in actually having a dialogue are blocked and deleted. And I've said before that blocking and deleting people from my own online homes is not censorship, which is what some people call it, and they cry censorship if I delete and block horribly obnoxious, self-righteous, not helping anybody comments. It's not censorship, it's house cleaning. I wouldn't let you come into my home, my actual home, and just leave droppings all over my house. You wouldn't be welcome. And so you can't come to my online homes and just leave droppings. You're not welcome. So it's not censorship. It's just house cleaning. You can leave droppings in your own house. Like, that's the point. Like, censorship means that someone stops you from leaving droppings anywhere, or maybe not just droppings, but contributing. So if you want to contribute to different topics on your own page or on other people's pages, if they don't have a problem with it, have at it. But you don't get to do that in mine. So thank you for everyone who does come to my online homes and encourage dialogue and conversation. You can disagree with me, but that's very different than, I'll stick with my analogy, leaving droppings. So I don't defend myself against these accusations, but it has always been my mission to provide a perspective about things related to animals in this world and our interaction with them, our treatment of them, our perception of them, our need to protect them, and the most effective ways to do so. And so I thought this subject needed more airing out. I know there are misconceptions, and in the end, someone who has that perspective, I'm not trying to change her mind. She probably won't even listen to this episode. But my point is, maybe there are other people who have that perspective, and I just want to air it out and unpack it. I've said again and again that there are very few things in this world that are black and white. I've said again and again that the world is imperfect and that sometimes there are gray areas we need to confront. Now, I talked a bit about this already in a podcast. Well, I've talked about it a million times, but I talked about it in a podcast episode I produced a few years ago called Planning and Preparing for a Dream Trip to Africa. At the time, it had been suggested by a supporter, Jennifer, knowing I had already had a trip to four countries in Africa planned at the time. She said it might be helpful to have an episode that talked about what people needed to do prior to going on a trip to African countries in terms of vaccines we needed, what to eat and drink, what to avoid, what to see, what to do, what to avoid. And it was a great suggestion, and there it is. You can listen to it whenever you like. However, there is so much more to say, because since recording that episode, I've learned so much about the countries we went to, namely Rwanda and Botswana. We were also in Zimbabwe and South Africa. Having been there, especially Botswana once, been back to Rwanda now, staying a month, and having another trip planned to Botswana in December 2020, I've thought about what these countries are doing a lot. I think about this a lot. We vet everything we do before we travel, either personally or professionally, whether we do, you know, we're doing them, these trips on our own or through CPG Vegan Trips. However, I'm still always thinking about these things. You know, we might vet something and then get there and think, oh gosh, I'm not sure I'm really comfortable with this. And okay, it's all right. You can change your mind or have new thoughts or add something to those thoughts. And so I'm always doing that. And I hope it's valuable for you to just kind of hear my thoughts about it. Again, you don't have to agree. You don't have to have your mind changed, but here's just some more data. Now, whether or not you're planning to visit Rwanda or the African continent at all, I do hope you'll listen, because the wildlife tourism or ecotourism or sustainable tourism topic is an important one that needs unpacking, especially for those of us who want to do the right thing by the non-human animals of this world. Now, this topic is important to me as someone who travels, again, like I said, personally and professionally, and the trips we host have a very positive impact on the animal protection work we support with our tourism dollars, and a very positive impact on the hotels and restaurants we work with to move them towards serving delicious, cruelty-free, plant-based food, and toward reducing waste, because we also address the waste issue in these countries as well. Now, I'm aware that travel, especially plane travel, has its own large environmental footprint. I live in that contradiction. It's not what I'm talking about today, but if you want to post that I'm already being a hypocrite because I fly to these places, you can do that. And I'm quite aware of it. But what's worth saying is, these days, it does seem like anyone and everyone with a foot in the tourism marketing door is spouting, you know, eco-friendly, green, sustainable tourism. There's such a proliferation of these terms, and we know that. We know about greenwashing. It's overused. The word green is overused and eco-friendly and ecotourism. It's overused. And I think now more than ever, it's necessary to educate ourselves about what it means. Now, I did a podcast episode called Avoiding Animal Cruelty When Traveling to Thailand and Everywhere Else. And I talked at length about how to avoid falling into the many traps of supporting what amounts to severe animal cruelty behind the scenes, even if it looks innocuous on the surface. And mostly, I mentioned that the best way to do that is to avoid paying for any kind of interaction with wild animals, not having a photo taken with a wild animal, especially a baby. If that's being marketed, like have your picture taken with a baby tiger or a baby, some kind of little monkey. Not paying for any kind of entertainment where animals are exhibited, confined, chained up, or forced to entertain, performing in any way. And obviously not riding any wild animal, even if you're told the animals love it. Which brings us to the mountain gorillas of Rwanda and the fact that we pay to see them and the fact that doing so contributes to their survival. So where to begin? Let's begin at the beginning. The mountain gorillas, this is my favorite part. I love talking about just kind of the beginnings of things. Mountain gorillas, which is a different species altogether from the lowland gorillas, live in only one particular region in East Africa, specifically on the volcanic slopes of Rwanda, Uganda, and the Democratic Republic of Congo, spanning four national parks. So three countries, four national parks, two in Uganda, one in Rwanda, one in Congo, all of which have seen their fair share of violence, warfare, poverty, and devastation, of which the mountain gorillas and other animals have, of course, been victims, along with many human animals. Now, it was about 9 million years ago that the group of primates that were to evolve into gorillas split from their common ancestor with humans and chimps. And this is when the genus Gorilla emerged. Now, originally, the mountain gorillas were considered one species until a recategorization in 2003. Like, this stuff is still being worked on. Nothing's done. Nothing's complete, right? When they divided the gorilla into two species, Gorilla gorilla and Gorilla Beringae. Now, before I explain why they're called Gorilla Beringae, I want to first explain how the genus even came to be called gorilla. It also paints a picture of the history of when gorillas were first discovered by Westerners. Two traditions of exploration come together in the history of the word gorilla. When Dr. Thomas Savage, an American missionary to Western Africa, made the first scientific description of gorilla in 1847, he gave the animal he was describing the Latin name Troglodytes gorilla. Now, in formulating this name, Savage was making reference to an ancient Greek version of a report in which Hanno, a Carthaginian, that is from Greek, the Greek city Carthage, a Carthaginian, he was a public official, he was a navigator, and he described a voyage he undertook to West Africa. Sometime after 500 BC, the date of the voyage is uncertain, Hanno sailed out of the Mediterranean through the Strait of Gibraltar and followed the coast of Africa southward, at least as far as Sierra Leone, perhaps even going as far as Cameroon. And by the way, if you're interested in why the names of these two countries are animalogies, that is, their names derived from animals, Sierra Leone and Cameroon, check out my podcast, Animology, and the episode called Geological Place Names from Animals. It's fascinating, if I do say so myself. However, I digress. In his report, Hanno records seeing members of a, quote, tribe of hairy women called gorillae, the name of which he allegedly learned from local informants. In fact, the gorillae that he saw may have been chimpanzees, or perhaps even the apes we call gorillas today, using the name that Savage bestowed on them 24 centuries after Hanno's voyage. Kind of cool, huh? So that's the gorilla part of the genus and species name, Gorilla gorilla. So you can see, right? Gorilla is the genus, gorilla is the species. But why the other species, Gorilla Beringae? Now, remember, in biological classification, the genus comes first, like I just said. Gorilla is the, in this case, gorilla is the genus, and the species comes next, like Homo sapiens. Homo is the genus, sapiens is the specific species together making up the species Homo sapiens. Tyrannosaurus rex, Tyrannosaurus is the genus, rex is the species, Tyrannosaurus rex making up the species. And so gorilla gorilla is one species, I'm not just stuttering, and Gorilla Beringae is another species. The reason for the second species is because of a man named Frederick Robert von Berengay, a German army officer who lived from 1865 to 1940, and he traveled to East Africa in August of 1902. He was there to visit the King of Rwanda and then proceed north to, quote, the row of volcanoes. The purpose of the trip was to visit the German outposts in what was then German East Africa in order to keep in touch with the local chiefs and to confirm good relations, while strengthening, of course, the influence and power of the German government in these regions. Now, you may not realize it, but the Germans arrived in Rwanda in the late 19th century at the height of colonialism. The 1885 Conference of Berlin declared that the area that was later to become Rwanda and Burundi would be under German influence and control. It was 9 years after this conference in 1894 that the first European traveled to Rwanda. So 1894, first European traveled to Rwanda, you know, as controlling it. During World War I, the Belgians gained control of Rwanda and Burundi. And after that war, after World War I, on August 23rd, 1923, the League of Nations mandated Rwanda and Burundi under Belgian supervision. And it was the Belgians who further stoked divisions and tensions in Rwanda between the Hutus and the Tutsis, which led to the civil war, which led to the genocide. So Berengay, he was German before it was Belgian territory, arrived in Rwanda in 1902. And one of the things he set out to do is to climb Mount Sabinyo, which is one of the five now dormant volcanoes in the north of Rwanda in what is now called Volcanoes National Park. Now, the following is a translation of Captain von Berengay's report of the expedition. You're not going to like some of it. From October 16th to 18th, senior physician Dr. Engeland and I, together with only a few askaris, which are military troops, local military troops, and the absolutely necessary baggage, attempted to climb the so far unknown Karunga ya Sabinyo, which, according to my estimation, must have a height of 3,300 meters. That's about 10,000 feet for us non-metric folks. At the end of the first day, we camped on a plateau at a height of 2,500 meters. The natives climbed up to our campsite to generously supply us with food. We left our camp on October 17th, taking with us a tent, 8 loads of water, 5 askaris, and porters as necessary. After 4.5 hours of tracking, we reached the height of 3,100 meters and tracked through bamboo forest. Although using elephant trails for most of the way, we encountered much undergrowth, which had to be cut before we could pass. After 2 hours, we reached a stony area with vegetation consisting mainly of blackberry and blueberry bushes. Step by step, we noticed the vegetation becoming poorer and poorer. The ascent became steeper and steeper, and climbing became more difficult. For the last 1.25 hours, we climbed only over rock. After covering the ground with moss we collected, we erected our tent on a ridge at a height of 3,100 meters. The ridge was extremely narrow so that the pegs of the tent had to be secured in the abyss. The askaris and the porters found shelter in rock caverns, which provided protection against the biting cold wind. From our campsite, we were able to watch a herd of big black monkeys, which tried to climb the crest of the volcano. We succeeded in killing 2 of these animals. And with a rumbling noise, they tumbled into a ravine, which had its opening in a northeasterly direction. After 5 hours of strenuous work, we succeeded in retrieving one of these animals using a rope. It was a big, human-like male monkey of 1.5 meters in height and a weight of more than 200 pounds. His chest had no hair, and his hand and feet were of enormous size. Unfortunately, I was unable to determine its type because of its size. It could not very well be a chimpanzee or a gorilla, and in any case, the presence of gorillas had not been established in the area around the lakes. End quote. So remember, this is 1902. So on the journey back, the skin and one of the hands of the animal that von Berengay collected were taken by a hyena, but the rest was sent to the Natural History Museum in Berlin, where they examined the body, and it was documented by Dr. Paul Matschi. He identified it as a new species of gorilla and named it after Berengay. So just to be clear, the mountain gorilla, well, it's also considered a subspecies, so it's technically, the mountain gorilla we're talking about today is technically Gorilla Berengay Berengay, because it's a subspecies. And it's one of 2 subspecies of the eastern gorilla, Gorilla Berengay. The other subspecies is the eastern lowland gorilla, or Grauer's gorilla, Gorilla Berengay Graui, Growery, named after a 19th century Australian zoologist. Now, I know it's hard to reconcile Beringay's shooting of these individuals with the fact that their species is named after them, but it was a different time, and it was his bringing the remains to Berlin that we began to learn about these majestic animals. Do I wish it could have been done a different way? Do I wish it was done? Yes, of course, but there you have it. That is what happened. And that it happened, we started learning about the mountain gorillas. Now, in 1925, Carl Akeley, a hunter from the American Museum of Natural History who wished to study the gorillas, convinced Albert I of Belgium, remember, this is now a Belgian territory, to establish the Albert National Park to protect the animals of the Virunga Mountains. It was later named the Virunga National Park. So, again, 1925, Albert I granted the wish to make this area Albert National Park. It was later named Virunga National Park, and it remains today a national park in the eastern part of the Democratic Republic of Congo. Unfortunately, it's a very dangerous conservation project. I'll talk about it a little later on. Just last year, at least 12 rangers were killed in clashes with militia and smugglers, making it one of the bloodiest periods in the park history. It's a very dangerous area. It's incredibly sad. Congo needs some new leadership and changes, which is an understatement. So that was 1925, when a portion of this forest was set aside to protect the gorillas at the behest of Carl Akeley, who was a hunter. So at the behest of a hunter, a portion of this forest was set aside. Now, as an aside, and this is a conversation for another time, it is very interesting when you look at the history of conservation and national parks, whether it's in the United States or elsewhere, hunters played a large role in protecting large swaths of land. Like, again, not easy to reconcile what feels like a contradiction to many of us, but indeed, there's no denying the role that hunters have played in preserving natural space, even if it was for their own gain. In the end, space was preserved, and the animals, it's a win for the animals. It's a win for us too, for those of us who do frequent national parks, regional parks, etc. Now, fast forward to 1959, when George Schaller, he's a wildlife biologist and conservationist, began his 20-month observation of the mountain gorilla. So people talk about Diane Fossey as being the first to go there. It's not true in terms of studying the mountain gorillas. In 1959, the first to go there, to study them, to observe them for 20 months, was George Schaller, S-C-H-A-L-L-E-R. Little was known about the life of the gorillas in the wild until the publication of his book, The Mountain Gorilla, Ecology and Behavior, in 1963. And that was the first book that conveyed to the general public just how profoundly intelligent and gentle gorillas really are, contrary to commonly held beliefs at the time. Now, don't forget, King Kong, that movie, had already been made into a movie in the 30s. And so into the public consciousness that gorillas are just these massive, dangerous animals, aggressive animals. And of course, another version was to follow in the 1970s. But this was 1963. And then Schaller in 1964 recounted his epic two-year study in the book, The Year of the Gorilla, which also provides a broader historical perspective on the efforts to save one of our nearest relatives from the brink of extinction. Now enter Diane Fossey, who had support from the National Geographic Society and Louis Leakey, who was a paleoanthropologist and an archaeologist, and whose work, along with his wife, a fellow paleontologist, Mary Leakey, was instrumental in demonstrating that humans evolved in Africa. So Fossey followed Schaller's field research on mountain gorillas in the Virungas, right, in Congo, though she eventually went over to Rwanda because it was too unsafe in Congo in 1967. And she made Rwanda her base until her murder in 1985. So almost 20 years she was there. Both Schaller and Fossey were instrumental in dispelling the public perception of gorillas as violent monsters by demonstrably establishing the deep compassion, social intelligence evident among gorillas, and how very closely their behavior parallels that of humans. Schaller, by the way, is still alive in his 80s, and he lives with his wife in New Hampshire. Now, most people associate the mountain gorillas with Diane Fossey, and indeed, she was one of their greatest champions, making new observations about them, completing the first accurate census. That's one of the reasons Leakey wanted her to go there, and establishing active conservation practices such as anti-poaching patrols. She founded the Digit Fund, whose name was changed and which today remains the Diane Fossey Gorilla Fund International, which we, for those of you listening, you know, we went there, we went to the headquarters, and because of Ellen DeGeneres and Portia de Rossi, they are expanding the headquarters there and making it an entire basically campus to study, to learn, to encourage students to come and learn about the mountain gorillas. So that's the Diane Fossey Gorilla Fund. And it's still, we're there at the headquarters. The headquarters, I think, are in San Francisco. Are they in San Francisco? Where are they? But we were there at the headquarters in Rwanda. So Diane Fossey established her headquarters, her research headquarters, in the volcanoes, in the mountains. In fact, between the Carisimbi, I mentioned Sabinho, that's one volcano, it's one mountain. There's five in Rwanda, up in the volcanoes. There's Sabinho, I can't remember the other two, and then there's Carisimbi and Bisoke. In between Carisimbi and Bisoke, she established her research center called Karasoke Research Center, taking Kara from Carisimbi and Oke from Bisoke Mountains. In between the two is Karasoke. The highlight of our most recent trip to Rwanda was hiking up to Karasoke, where Diane Fossey's grave is, and where the grave of many of the gorillas killed while she was there trying to protect them remains. She buried them, and there they remain. All of the cabins were destroyed after the genocide during the refugee crisis, but you can still see the foundations of the cabins where she and other researchers lived and worked to protect the gorillas. The hike was a grueling 6.5-hour muddy round trip slog, but it was so worth it. I will never forget that journey, having walked exactly in the footsteps of Diane Fossey and all of those who dedicated their lives, or who continue to dedicate their lives, to studying and protecting the mountain gorillas. Now, I've talked about Diane Fossey before, of course, about how she was one of my first animal protection heroes and how she was a very difficult woman. She was tenacious and mercurial and stubborn. And it's because of her tenacity and her stubbornness that the world learned about the mountain gorillas that we value and cherish so much. And it's because of her tenacity and stubbornness that so many of the descendants of the gorillas she knew and loved are alive today. But it was also her tenacity and stubbornness that blinded her to the complexities of the region in which she was living and working, and with the Rwandan people, whom, as many people who worked with her have reported, she resented. It blinded her to the conservation approach that was to become the most successful conservation story to date, an approach that many would argue is the reason this species has gone from the critically endangered list to the endangered list. Now, of course, the goal is to move them off the endangered list altogether, but progressing from critically endangered to endangered is something to celebrate. Now, in the past, I've recommended the book Gorillas in the Mist, which was written by Diane Fossey about the mountain gorillas and adapted into a Hollywood movie starring Sigourney Weaver. I've also recommended Woman in the Mist, which is by Farley Mowat, about Diane Fossey. Now, I want to recommend another book, and that's In the Kingdom of Gorillas, The Quest to Save Rwanda's Mountain Gorillas, by husband and wife team Bill Weber and Amy Vetter, longtime world-renowned conservationists, ecologists, primatologist. In 1978, now remember, Diane Fossey was still alive then. She was killed in 1985. So in 1978, Amy Vetter and Bill Weber arrived in Rwanda as newlywed graduate students to study the gorillas at Karasoke, okay, the research station founded and established by Diane Fossey in 1967. They learned that the government was considering converting gorilla habitat into a cattle ranch. Cattle ranching, I swear, is the bane of all existence. And they arrived, sadly, right after poachers killed Digit. This is the silverback who Diane Fossey was very close to, who became very famous due to Diane Fossey's research, hence the Digit Fund I mentioned earlier. And in fact, Diane had requested that she be buried next to her beloved Digit, and so she is. Her grave is right next to where she buried Digit. And it's an incredibly magical spot. Muddy though it was. It was very muddy. Very quickly frustrated and sad and angry about the plight of the mountain gorillas, Bill and Amy helped found the Mountain Gorilla Project, which would become the pioneering ecotourism effort designed to attract visitors willing to pay hundreds of dollars to see free-ranging mountain gorillas and thus make the preservation of gorilla habitat at least as profitable as clearing the land for farming or cattle grazing. integrated into and still a huge aspect of what makes it work today is working with the Rwandans rather than seeing them as part of the problem, which is what Diane Fossey unfortunately did in this case. We're all complicated beings, and she was certainly a complicated, complex human being. Dr. Vetter and Dr. Weber describe their struggle to keep the mountain gorillas alive and thriving in their book, In the Kingdom of Gorillas. So I highly recommend it. The book highlights the tremendous difficulty of working on behalf of gorillas in a country that is among the poorest and most densely populated regions of Africa, still is, and that it's definitely the most populated. It's definitely rising in terms of poverty. It's definitely gotten out of the poverty it was once in, but it's still a poor country. And they talked about how in the mid-1990s, of course, the difficulty of working in a country that was the site of one of the worst episodes of genocide in human history. And their efforts have paid off. When Diane Fossey established Karasoki Research Center, and when Weber and Vetter proposed their then revolutionary ecotourism scheme to the Rwandan government, it was believed that the mountain gorillas would be extinct by the year 2000. Instead, their population, I'm going to cry, has doubled. I've said this a million times, but it still moves me to tears. Today, the mountain gorilla population living in the Virunga Mountains has grown from 480 in 2010 to 604 as of June 2016. So in 6 years, it went from 480 to 604. Now, these are the most recent numbers, but of course, there have been births and deaths since then. The point is, combined with a separate mountain gorilla population living in Bwindi Impenetrable National Park in Uganda, that's a mouthful, this brings the number of mountain gorillas to more than 1,000 individuals in that region. That's the only region they live. So in the region they live in the world, they are now number 1,000. And that is why it's one of the great conservation success stories and why they were upgraded from critically endangered to endangered. Good news, of course, they still face many problems, and 1,000 is still a very low number. But even though those problems are different today than they were when Fossey was alive, they still have threats. And again, these are threats that, you know, that so many animals face, and most of it has to do with deforestation and habitat loss. At the time when Diane Fossey was alive, one of the greatest threats was poaching, primarily for souvenirs. People thought it was cool to have a gorilla hand as an ashtray or a gorilla head on their mantelpiece. There was also the poaching of infants. A lot of them were sold to zoos. It's turned out that that's not done anymore, just obviously, thank goodness, because of international laws. But also, mountain gorillas do not thrive at all in captivity. When you see a gorilla in a zoo, unfortunately, which is an incredibly unfortunate thing, they're lowland gorillas. They won't be mountain gorillas. So luckily those problems are gone. Like, those are not the problems for the mountain gorillas anymore. Direct poaching has pretty much stopped. The biggest risk they now have is a very small habitat. They live in a region that has some of the highest population densities in Africa. They're restricted to a small area. So there's risk of disease transmission because they're very susceptible to human diseases. And people, even though they aren't poaching these gorillas, they still depend on the forest. They go in and they hunt other animals like antelope and smaller animals, and gorillas can get caught in snares. Now, as I said, Diane Fossey was and will remain one of my first animal protection heroes. She was the first to turn mountain gorillas like Digit and Puck, whose grave we also saw, into celebrities among Westerners, to the point where Digit's death at the hands of poachers led Walter Cronkite, if you don't know who I'm talking about, look him up, to report on his death as a lead story on the CBS Evening News on February 3rd, 1978. However, many conservationists credit Dr. Weber and Dr. Vetter with doing the more important behind-the-scenes work of opposing habitat destruction and bolstering the gorilla's profile among the Rwandans themselves. As is a quote from George Schaller, "I went and studied the gorillas in the 1960s, which was useful, and Diane Fossey got people to pay attention when poaching was a serious problem. But the people who really saved the gorillas and planned for their future," Schaller said, "were Bill and Amy." So in their book, In the Kingdom of Gorillas, Dr. Vetter and Dr. Weber describe the joyous parts of their work, the realization that if they find gorilla encounters, I mean, like, encountering a gorilla is really one of the greatest thrills. And they said as much, and anyone who's visited them can attest to that. And because they felt that, they knew that other people, and they were right, would feel the same, and that that would be a key to the gorilla survival. Their efforts to habituate gorillas to humans in small and strictly controlled doses, not in any way that was going to harm or hurt the gorillas, but to habituate them in small doses, and spread the news about their importance across Rwanda into schools and villages and town halls, to talk up gorillas and conservation among the locals who knew very little about their ape neighbors, but once informed and shown pictures and films, fell in love with the gorillas, as we all do when we see them. And they became committed gorilla ambassadors, and they are. And it is so impressive to see the work that Rwanda is doing. Now, Vetter and Weber talk about Fosse. She was large of personality. She was large of stature. Do you know she was 6'2"? I don't think I realized that. She was volatile. She was eccentric. And by all accounts, she was filled with insecurities. Despite reservations, Fosse accepted their proposed project. She was not in favor of it. And for a while, they worked well together. They admired her capacity to present gorillas as individuals. They admired her work. But as time grew on, they grew uncomfortable with her scorn for Africans, for Rwandans, and they started slowly separating. More to the point, Dr. Fosse seemed surprisingly uninterested in issues of habitat conservation. She spent all of her energies fighting poachers and amassing a sizable collection of guns. As I said, she eventually came around to it, but in the beginning, she was absolutely opposed to the proposition that ecotourism could bring money into the region for gorilla conservation. So based on what at the time was a groundbreaking approach, Vetter and Weber believed that if the local people were given the right tools and incentives, they would contribute to the conservation of these animals. Now, Savannah Park safari tourism was the model in the 1970s. That meant going to see the lions and the elephants and the zebras from the comfort of a Land Rover, which we do when we go to Botswana, but then you head back to the lodge for a gin and tonic, right? Ecotourism was not yet a concept. And Weber and Vetter came up with this approach. It was radical at the time, but it seems visionary now. So they envisioned people setting out on foot, following elephant and buffalo trails, and eventually finding and observing the gorillas deep in the forest, in their home. So they started training local guides to lead small groups of no more than 8 visitors for an hour spent with a primate family. And that's what the model is today. And people thought they were nuts. A lot of them said people don't want to get wet. They don't want to get muddy. European tourists, they don't want to be cold. They just want to be comfortable. They want to sit in a Land Rover and just, you know, drink some wine while looking at lions. And they didn't believe that it would work. When the local government said, go ahead, try it, they tried it. And the three-pronged approach is education, tourism, and anti-poaching. So they drew on lessons from their biology and social science studies. They argued that their plan could bring in more revenue on a sustainable basis, persuaded the government that that would work more than cattle ranching. And without the huge capital that investment that ranching required. So introducing tourism, working in a partnership with Rwandans, that meant a break with Fosse. She argued that the daily human visitation would upset the primates. And I understand her concern, of course. She thought it was going to hasten their demise. She was skeptical. She was also skeptical that Rwandans were capable of managing gorilla conservation efforts. And she was wrong. Dr. Weber, Dr. Vetter eventually became estranged from Diane Fosse, and of course, nonetheless, they were deeply disturbed when she was murdered in her cabin in December 1985. To this day, her killer is not known. I do recommend watching the National Geographic documentary about Fosse and her death called Secrets in the Mist, available to watch on Amazon Prime. Now, Weber was appointed to the director of an organization called Wildlife Conservation Society's Africa Program in 1988. So she left, they moved to New York, and they visited Rwanda annually. 2 years after they left, the civil war erupted in Rwanda, and then it escalated into the horrific 1994 genocide of more than 800,000 people in 100 days. A census conducted after recovery revealed a continued uptick in the gorilla population, even during the civil war and the genocide. Both sides, the Hutus, the Tutsis, had agreed not to fight within the park because they had recognized by then the tremendous economic value of the park and tourism. Again, I'm tearing up. That's incredible. Now, We know that certain charismatic individuals tend to get the spotlight when many people are behind the scenes, and that's the way it is, right? That's the way it is. Humans are always searching for meaning, and we like to find heroes. And by all accounts, by my account, Fosse was a hero, flawed as she was, as most heroes are, but she wasn't the only hero. Most people have never heard of Dr. Weber and Dr. Vetter, but it's really their plan put into place that has led to the protection of the mountain gorillas and their habitat. Today, mountain gorillas are a national treasure in Rwanda. A silverback appears on the 5,000 franc bill. There's an annual baby gorilla naming ceremony. It's called the Kwita Izina, which celebrates each year's new batch of gorilla babies. It's become a celebrity-infested event. Gorilla images adorn an array of Rwandan brands, from hotels to coffee. The way it works, everyone always asks me how it works, is up to 96 visitors each day, in groups of 8 at the most, spend 60 strictly monitored minutes with one of the country's 12 habituated primate families at Volcanoes National Park. For this, they pay up to $1,500 each person. Now, 2 years ago when we were there, it was half that price. Tourism in Rwanda today generates more than $400 million annually, more than coffee, more than tea, and minerals combined. According to the Rwanda Development Board, the most popular tourist activity is tracking the mountain gorillas. There are other animals, and we'll talk about them in a minute, but it's mostly the gorillas. For as long as I can remember, I dreamt about going to see the mountain gorillas. Rwanda seemed like a very far off place that I would never get to. And the truth is, if I never did see them, if it was better for them that I didn't see them, I could live with that. I do believe it's a privilege and not a right to see every inch of this beautiful earth. And if animals would be harmed by my visit to their home, then I just as soon not go. But the model of conservation that works for mountain gorillas means that it's actually beneficial for them that people visit and pay. One of the reasons it's working is because the Rwandan government is so committed to their protection and to the viability of the lucrative ecotourism trade. Obviously, it benefits them and the villagers and the people. Also, because they're working with the local communities, as Weber and Vetter made sure of in their plan, and it's working, local villages all around Rwanda receive a percentage of the national park fee. So they're incentivized to make this model work. And they see it as a benefit, as an ally, rather than as an intruder. Money from tourism fees is invested back into the communities and health centers, schools, other infrastructure. And it's a model that's working, and it's thanks to the vision of Dr. Amy Vetter and Dr. Bill Weber. But truly, the heroes of this story are not just Diane Fossey or Amy Vetter or Bill Weber. The heroes of this story are the resilient, strong, courageous Rwandan people and the guides, the trackers, and the soldiers who work to protect the gorillas and their habitat, some of whom were poachers themselves, but who now protect rather than threaten the gorillas. I've seen the mountain gorillas 3 times now, and I can tell you that this entire model is incredibly well managed. One of the things I've loved the most is being with the trackers and the guides and the rangers and witnessing how proud they are of the work they're doing to protect the gorillas and their habitat and the golden monkeys, who are another non-human primate endangered in the Volcanoes Park Forest. Being a forest ranger in Rwanda is an incredibly sought-after job. But it's a dangerous one worldwide. Even though rangers they're safe in Rwanda, it's not the case in neighboring Congo, in Virunga National Park. If you haven't seen the documentary called Virunga, I highly recommend it. 150 rangers have been murdered in that park in the past decade. It's a UNESCO World Heritage Site. It's one of the most biologically diverse protected areas in Africa, and it is the world's most dangerous park. It's home to 3 species of great apes and other endangered species, including elephants, of which there are now fewer than 400 in the park. And park rangers work. They dedicate their lives to protect these animals from poachers. And the latest deaths continue a tragic pattern of brutal ambushes against rangers. They are heroes. Now, when you're walking with the guides and the trackers carry AK-47s for protection, certainly to protect themselves. As I said, the Rwandan trackers are safe, but also to scare a wild animal. There are Cape buffalo, there are elephants, forest elephants. if one of the gorillas charges, which never happens, but if someone provokes a gorilla, like it could happen, they shoot in the air to scare the animals. They would never shoot at the animals. But they do carry an AK-47 to give you an idea of the danger they're facing. And your guide, as you're walking with them, works with the trackers on a walkie-talkie to find the gorilla group you've been assigned to. The most famous guide in Volcanoes National Park is a man named Francois Bigirimana, and many people have had him as a guide. He was Diane Fossey's porter back in the early 1980s. He is the oldest, and I swear the fittest, guide in the park. I have a video interview with him on the page for today's website, podcast episode on the website. But all of the guides I've met are so enthusiastic to be there doing this work. So you walk with your guide and your porters, who I highly recommend you hire. You have no idea how long your trek is going to be, and they're incredibly helpful. Plus, a small amount of money to you goes a long way for local Rwandans, so it gives a job to these porters until you find the gorilla group you've been assigned to. The rules are simple. You stay still, you be quiet, you don't get closer than 22 feet or so from a gorilla. If one approaches, you back up. Now, a gorilla will break you in two if you try to hurt them or one of their clan, but honestly, they are the most gentle, majestic, beautiful creatures I've ever been in the presence of. People ask me all the time if I ever felt nervous or threatened, and the answer is absolutely not. Even the guides will tell you that you're most likely to get hurt on the hike than be attacked by a gorilla. They are so large. They are so incredible. You don't want to be run over by one. And they are the most gentle animals I've ever seen. Now, I got to tell you, as much as I love the forest in the south, the national forest called Nyungwe, the chimpanzees don't have the same effect on me. They have a different effect. I think they're terrifying. The chimpanzees are incredibly intimidating. And they're less than half the size of the mountain gorillas. Adult male mountain gorillas can stand up to 6 feet tall. And weigh 300 to 485 pounds. Common chimpanzees have a standing height of about 3.5 to 5 feet. I mean, still tall. But adult males weigh about like 88 to 130 pounds. A female weighs 60 to 110 pounds. And yet chimpanzees are really intimidating to be around. Not so the mountain gorillas, if that gives you any idea. But still, go to the chimpanzee trek when you go to Rwanda. Do not miss going to Nyungwe. It's an amazing, magical forest. So each human group, as I said, can have no more than eight people, Then you have your guides and your porters with you as well. And only 10 groups go out each day. Now, the gorilla groups that I've seen thus far, if you want to know, are a Gisha, Hirwa, and a Simbi. Now, having so few people is to protect the mountain gorillas from too much agitation, of course, and exposure to disease. And again, every gorilla group sees tourists, humans, for 1 hour a day. And they see humans at other times as well because the trackers actually stay with them once you, the human tour group, leaves. They're checking to make sure everyone's safe and healthy. And of course, every gorilla has a name, so they're noting any changes in any of the individuals. And they're also noting where the family nests that night. So that when they leave the forest, they know where to start tracking the next day so that the tourists, human tourists like us, can find them. And that's why they will say that, of course, they can't guarantee that you'll see a mountain gorilla, but it's pretty close to being guaranteed. They have a pretty good machine going there. Now, when you find the gorillas, they could really care less about you. They will watch you. They're curious, but they really are just hanging out. They are not distressed or disturbed. Now, the babies are more curious. They're more courageous than the adults. And of course, they've learned from their adults to not interact with us, but invariably a naughty baby will come close to us, and the rangers, using vocalizations and gentle gestures, will discourage this. There's no touching the gorillas, but I'm not going to lie. On one of our treks, a little baby ran by me and smacked me on the leg. I got leg smacked by a baby mountain gorilla, and I loved it. So basically, once you find your gorilla group, you're just in awe. You watch them eat, you watch them play, you watch them wrestle, you watch them snore, you watch them fart, you watch them cuddle and forage and just care for their young. And on one of our groups, one of the groups that we saw, Hirwa, there were two gorgeous silverbacks. One of them apparently is the best with all the babies. And he was amazing. It was like being in a nursery school. There were like six or seven babies sitting around this big dude. Like they were just babies at a nursery school. We saw a lot of wrestling of baby gorillas, and a lot, the mamas are like nursing, or the mamas are eating. The papas, they're kind of just, these silverbacks, they're just relaxing. It's a lot of work looking after a troop of gorillas, and they're in charge. So they're usually exhausted, and they're just like lying down and hanging out. So when you're done, when your hour is up, you whisper your goodbyes and you quietly leave. and you have the impression that you will never be the same again, and you aren't. As I started with, do I wish animals were valued for who they are and not for economic value that benefits countries and people and governments? Yes, of course. But we don't live in that world. Not now, we don't. And the work Rwanda and that of other similar countries is doing should be celebrated. In fact, a study published in the Global Ecology and Conservation publication shows that the countries that have been the best at conservation tend to be the ones with the most to gain from it economically. This is a quote from the publication. Megafauna is a big tourism draw. It can have significant economic value if their values are harnessed appropriately and sustainably. For example, countries such as Kenya, Botswana, and South Africa have successfully harnessed the appeal of large mammals to overseas visitors and wildlife-based tourism so much that it now comprises significant portions of their gross domestic product. The countries with the highest scores on the mega conservation index. Now, this just doesn't mean like those that are just doing it. It means those that are doing it the best. Number 10 is Rwanda. They're not even the highest. So number 10 is Rwanda. Number 9 is Zambia. 8 is Canada. 7 is the Central African Republic. 6 is Norway. 5 is Zimbabwe. 4 is Bhutan. They don't have a lot of large animals, but they have a national law that prohibits more than 40% of the land being populated. This means that 60% of the land in Bhutan is forest. Like, they're amazing. 3 is Tanzania, 2 is Namibia, and number 1 is Botswana. Now, I want to mention one more example of the encouraging conservation work being done in Rwanda, and it may answer some questions or ethical concerns you may have about animal safaris. You're familiar with Volcanoes National Park now. It's in the northern part of Rwanda. That's where the mountain gorillas are. I've mentioned Nyungwe National Park in the forest in the forest in the south, which is where the chimpanzees are. And that was established only as recently as 2005. There's a third national park in Rwanda worth mentioning because it's a testament to hope and resilience and vision and vigilance. It's called Akagera National Park in the eastern part of the country. And unlike Volcanoes and Nyungwe, it's not a forest at all, but a savanna on which completely different animals live. But it was almost completely destroyed during the civil war, genocide, and refugee crisis. The park was first established in 1934, making it one of Africa's oldest national parks. It was originally about 1,000 square miles, but it's now just 400. Unfortunately, between 1990 and 1994, Akagera became a battleground between the Rwandan army and the Rwandan Patriotic Front, a rebel army mostly comprised of the Tutsi exiles. That's who came back, kind of ended the genocide, and so we have the history from there. In the immediate aftermath of the war, little was done to protect wildlife. Most of the Rwandan staff, researchers, or conservationists working in the parks had either left the country or been killed. Now, I'm going to link to a National Geographic article from which some of this information comes on the website. The new government, led by the victorious Rwandan Patriotic Front, prioritized the resettlement of ethnic Tutsi who had previously left in exile. They were living in exile. Rwanda was and remains, I've said before, a densely populated country with little availability of arable land. So the government allowed returnees and their estimated 700,000 cattle to settle in Akagera, as well as in an adjacent area formerly known as the Mutara Game Reserve. The returnees converged on the area, putting a huge strain on the park's delicate ecosystem. In a move to reduce conflicts between humans and wildlife, returnees were allowed to remain, but in 1997, the size of the park was reduced by 2/3, from that 1,000 I mentioned, 1,000 square miles, to about 430 square miles today. So a park that used to be 3.5 times bigger than New York City was reduced to a size smaller than Phoenix. It was one of the largest reductions in the size of a conservation area in modern African history. Local residents and park officials who worked in Akagera during that time say elephants spent less time inside the park because they were used to the old footprint than outside. So outside the park, they roamed their historic feeding grounds, they feasted on new crops, and that set up conflict. A single elephant can destroy up to a year's worth of farmers' income in one night. And then, of course, you have all the ungulates, the impala, the zebra, the buffaloes, the warthogs. They continue to graze in the same areas as the livestock, competing for food. Poachers and settlers had put so much pressure on it that many of its iconic animals, from lions to rhinos, disappeared in a few short years, leaving it a shell of its once amazing self. But in 2009, the Rwandan government shifted directions. They signed a 20-year contract with African Parks, a Johannesburg-based nonprofit that operates by taking over complete responsibility for the rehabilitation and management of conservation zones, including a sophisticated and well-managed anti-poaching campaign. Lions and the rest of the famed Big Five animals soon returned. Today, Cape Eland, warthogs, impala, giraffes, and zebras can be seen grazing in every direction. Tourism has increased. Conservationists have hailed the park's transformation and some hope it can serve as a model for what can happen when nature is encouraged to come back. And I really encourage you to look at my photos on the same website page for today's website. But quite literally, now in 2010, there were 600 buffalo and 600 hippos. Today, after installing the fence to keep the animals in a very safe way and to not create conflicts with humans, both species have multiplied to 3,000. Today, the Big Five are back. Leopards, lions, Cape buffalo, elephants, and rhinoceros. The numbers of people going are rising. So even when we were there the first time in Rwanda, we didn't go. Only 15,000 visited the park in 2010. Last year, that number jumped to 44,000, bringing in $2.2 million in revenue. We did a behind-the-scenes tour. I have to tell you that it was one of the highlights of my trip was just hearing about the work that these rangers are doing, that African Parks is doing. I'm not going to talk all about it here. I certainly encourage you to read about it. It is incredibly encouraging, and it's why I support this kind of wildlife tourism. And it's clearly why you do too, because we sold out of our Botswana trip, our 2020 trip, and we created another. So go to cpgtrips.com to join us. So in general, when it comes to seeing animals in the wild as part of a larger trip, as part of a tourism, you know, ecotourism, wildlife tourism, do your research, apply the principles I talk about in the ethical tourism episode about Thailand and other countries, and be discerning. But from my perspective, the conservation work being done in Rwanda should be a model around the world. I didn't even mention the fact that Rwanda plants millions of trees every year. It's one of the only countries in the world that has a positive rate of forestation. Every year, more trees are planted and protected in Rwanda than cut down. The challenge that mountain gorillas and golden monkeys face in volcanoes now, that, as I mentioned, because their population's growing, which is a good thing, their habitat will remain too small to sustain them as they grow. They need to reforest because they're butting up against farmland. There are now plans for a $200 million expansion of Volcanoes National Park and a project to reforest the habitat that was parceled for pyrethrum, which is a plant grown for pesticide use. That was announced very recently. It's going to be interesting to see what happens. It's a problem the government is trying to solve. And while there is strong leadership in this country and a will to protect the forests and their habitats, I'm hopeful. Now, do countries and companies around the world take advantage of wildlife and use it for profit? Yeah, 100%, no doubt. Do countries' conservation models change depending on who's in charge politically? Absolutely. The book I'm reading right now is called Poached: Inside the Dark World of Wildlife Trafficking by Rachel Love Newer, and it's a depressing reality. I plan on sharing more about wildlife trafficking with you another time, but in the meantime, go get the book, support Rachel's work, buy that book. Again, it's called Poached: Inside the Dark World of Wildlife Trafficking. It's so important to know what's happening. But is seeing mountain gorillas in Rwanda exploiting animals, or for that matter, the chimpanzees, the golden monkeys, or the safari animals we saw in Akagera National Park? Not on your life. And I hope you get to experience it one day. If you don't, you can obviously support the organizations working to support the conservation in this part of the world and support national parks in your part of the world. There's a lot we can do, whether we see them or not, for the animals. This is Colleen Patrick-Gaudreau. Thanks for listening.